I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 1913, Seeds of Conflict, premieres on Tuesday, June 30th on PBS. It's a little-known story of Palestine during the latter part of the Ottoman Empire and a time of harmony between Arabs and Jews living side by side in the cosmopolitan city of Jerusalem, where everybody walked pretty freely and were neighbors and even sang music together. How did this land of milk and honey, so rich in culture, diverse and peaceful, become the site of today's bitter and long time struggle? We're going to talk about that this hour with the writer and director of 1913, Seeds of Conflict. Ben Loderman is with us. He's an award-winning writer, director, and producer of current affairs and historical documentaries. His independent film, The People vs. Leo Frank, was broadcast nationally on PBS, and he's done a number of shows for Frontline and for American Experience. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Hi, Ben. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. Thank you.
Were you surprised to find this time of peace among Jews, Arabs, and Christians?
I was, because I knew nothing about the history before I started in on the project, So it was all a bit of a discovery for me.
Mm-hmm. You start the film with this very, very old, earliest moving image, 1913, before World War I. It's a significant film. Why is this significant, and what does it show?
Well, it's significant for a couple reasons. It was made in 1913, first of all, which makes it one of the earliest moving pictures of Palestine at that time. It was made by a very well-known Russian filmmaker named Noah Sokolovsky, so it has all the production values of a feature film for the time, which makes it very good and interesting to watch. And I think, lastly, it's important to say it was called a documentary at the time, but because it was sponsored by the World Zionist Organization, it was really a kind of travelogue advertising that land of milk and honey for Jews elsewhere to come. So it was a bit of propaganda as well.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of the Ottoman Empire, Ottoman rule of the area now that is so divisive. You talk about Jerusalem being this place, which is hard to imagine now, where everybody, you know, played music together and roamed pretty freely. Nobody had claimed certain parts of the city.
Well, I mean, if you go back 100 years, Palestine was near the end of the Ottoman Empire geographically, meaning it was far away and it was kind of a backwater, and so it wasn't particularly paid attention to in the center of the empire in Istanbul, where the capital is. So people were pretty free to do as they wanted to in this backwater place, and people generally got along. It was surprising to me how heterogeneous the society was and how intermixed. We at some point looked for any records of intermarriage, and we didn't find any.
Hmm.
But we found a lot of business partners. We found a lot of shared courtyards where people were living together. We found a lot of Jews who were helping their Muslim neighbors at Ramadan and Christians helping their Jewish friends at Jewish holidays, and both of the others helping the Christians when their holidays came around. So it was a pretty friendly place, actually.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Sultan? Did he have kind of a loose rule over this part of the Ottoman Empire, let people do as they please, and checked in rather infrequently?
Well, it's not the Sultan. It's not that the Sultan had so much loose rule. Is that whatever rule the Ottoman Parliament and the Sultan had together, it just couldn't be terribly enforced, you know, out at the edges of the empire, and this was one. So there were local representatives. There were people who went back and forth from Jerusalem in particular to Istanbul and back and forth. But other than that, pretty much what you wanted to do between the northern province of Beirut and the southern province of Sinai in the Sinai Desert, was pretty loosely organized and policed, I'd say, at that time.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the film shows us Jerusalem governed by Istanbul until the 1880s, you say, Sephardic Jews speaking Arabic and accepting a secondary status lived in the mountains. And then we saw a couple waves of Jews from other parts of Eastern Europe because of persecution come to Palestine, which kind of changed everything. Tell me about the early Sephardic Jews.
I think it's what people forget about is a time when Mediterranean Jews, or they called themselves Sephardic Jews, and today some call themselves Mizrahi Jews, but people from around the Mediterranean countries and throughout the Arab lands of the time were a minority. So there was something called the Tanzimat, which is an Ottoman organizational tool which gave Muslims and Muslim culture a kind of primacy within the empire. And then secondary to that, there were Jews and there were Christians. And as long as everybody understood their position and understood their taxation, it was generally good. What it meant was that people of Sephardic nature, like one of our characters, Albert Entebbe, who's a Jew born in Damascus of a long line of rabbis, considered themselves Ottoman. And when you're Ottoman, you subject yourself to Ottoman rule or sometimes Arab rule or Arab law, Sharia law. You speak Arabic. Hebrew is not a big thing going on in Palestine at that time. And you identify that way. So Jews from Arab lands did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess when you mention the numbers, 400,000 Ottomans, 60,000 Christians, and 20,000 Jews, it's obvious who's got the big majority, right?
Right, but it's the Muslims, remember. They're all Ottoman, but within Ottoman society, 400,000 Muslims, and then the Christians and the Jews, much smaller numbers.
Mm-hmm. So in 1881, Tsar Alexander of Russia is assassinated. Jews are suffering from extreme persecution. They're leaving, and some are coming to Palestine. Why?
Just a tiny percentage. I mean, the Jews were blamed when Tsar Alexander II is assassinated for more than the direct assassination, all of the economic turmoil that happens as a result of that in the Russian Empire, and these terrible riots and killings and rapings called pogroms are visited upon the Jews, and there is a sense of urgency and desperation to leave, and most do, except that 97%, I mean the vast majority, come to America because the main reason to leave is for some better life, some economic promise. And only those very few Jews in what became known as the first emigration wave or the first Aliyah in Hebrew came for spiritual reasons. And Jews had traditionally come to Palestine, often at the end of their life, to die in the Holy Land, to be buried in the Holy Land. And those people came and really had no problem fitting in with both the Sephardic Jewish population, the Arab Jews who were there, and the rest of the Ottomans who were there. So that worked well, and people worked together and lived together pretty harmoniously.
Mm-hmm. When did the Ottoman Empire become susceptible, and why, to the rise of nationalism?
Oh, gosh. I think the world over, at the turn of the century, nationalism was taking hold. It was taking hold in Europe. You had the French Revolution. You had different nationalist movements, and it was the time when those empires, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, began to crack a bit. And so, you know, in the earliest days, parts of North Africa, which had been part of the empire, started breaking off. And then as you get into the turn of the century and just beyond, parts of what we know now call the Slavic countries or Bulgaria, Greece, of course, Cyprus, and more of the empire just began falling away piece by piece, and largely because of an ethnic group, whether they were Armenians or the Greeks, you know, decided that they wanted their own autonomy, and that was kind of the wave politically of what was going on around the world then.
Mm-hmm. And you also had, tell us more about the Zionism gaining momentum, the Manifesto for the Jewish State, when that was written, and how it was that the place in the film you talk about, the first place to get Jews to rally around was Palestine.
Well, Zionism is just really a particular form of nationalism. So it was happening around the time that other nationalist movements were taking root. Zionism took root in about 1896 when a Jew from Vienna named Theodor Herzl wrote a kind of manifesto, a kind of pamphlet or small book that said, this is why and how we should have a homeland, that Jews should have a place to go that's free of the persecution in Europe, in Eastern Europe especially. And the only difference between the Jewish national movement called Zionism and other national movements was the Jews had no place. There was no land to particularly try to possess or take over or fight for. The Jews had no place. And so at a Zionist Congress about 1988 in Vienna, Theodore Roosevelt, who's written, sorry, Theodore Herzl.
Theodore Herzl.
Wrong manifesto. Theodore Herzl, you know, brings this idea of a homeland to the Congress, and it's very well received. And then he pulls out a bit of a surprise and says, and you know what? I have been trying to chase leaders in Europe, in Britain, in Germany. He had followed the Kaiser to Jerusalem on a visit. And the British have offered us a place to go. It's called Uganda, and it's in a place called Africa. And the Zionist Congress was made up of mostly European and quite a few Eastern European Jews, and they all said, are you kidding? We're not going to someplace called Uganda. We're going where Jews have their heritage for 2,000 years. We're going to Palestine. And so he was actually shouted down and overruled, and then the waves of emigration to Palestine began.
And who used the phrase, a land without a people, for a people without a land?
Well, it's a funny phrase because it was actually originally attributed to Lord Shaftesbury in England, who is not Jewish. But Jews early on in this process took that up as their mantra, a land for a people, for a people without a land. And the key word in that is a. And what does A mean? Because Jews were not blind. They saw that there were people in this land of Palestine, namely Arabs, Ottomans. But they didn't consider the Arabs of Palestine a people. They were people, and they lived there, but they were nothing like a national movement in Jewish eyes. So that allowed them to think that they had a certain right and hold on that land.
And when did the tensions begin? With the was it the second wave Jews who were coming from Eastern Europe, that there was a difference in relations with the Bedouin? Is that the wave where problems surfaced?
No, tensions began from the get-go. So even from the first Aliyah, the first immigration of Jews from Russia, when they tried to buy land in a fashion that we're very used to in the West, which entails land deeds and paperwork and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And Jews were very good at this. They were good at trading. They were good at understanding laws and principles like that. And they were able to work with local Ottoman officials to controvert the greater parliament and sultan's rule that Jews shouldn't come just to Palestine and settle. They can come to the empire and settle, but the last thing that the Ottoman sultan wanted was another ethnic group to contend with, because he knew, and it's true, that each one of these ethnic groups was part of this wave of nationalism and wanting their own territory. So they didn't want Jews to settle just in Palestine, but local Jews on the ground worked with local Ottoman officials who were willing to be bribed or look the other way to get that paperwork in order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those lands had passed between hands for a long time, and sometimes often. So, and often between rich Arab families that didn't always live there. So there was an Arab family in Beirut, and they would trade a large chunk of land, and I'm talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres, with another Arab family that might live in Jerusalem, or it might live in Damascus, or it might live in Baghdad. And that never affected the people who were actually living there on the ground. And those were Arabs who saw themselves as custodians of the land. They had a completely different relationship to the land, and they saw their self-worth in being able to pass their land to their children and their children and through the generations. Suddenly you have Jews come in and they say, great, here's the paperwork. This land is mine now. Could you please leave?
Mm-hmm.
And the people on the ground who had been on the ground for generations, regardless of who owned the land, said, no, you've got to be kidding us. So there were frictions from the get-go, but they were frictions. When the Jews of the second immigration wave, the second Aliyah, who are much more entrenched at that point in Russian politics, in socialism, and they decide to come and build for themselves a place where they own the land, where they should work the land, they thought, where they should be completely self-sufficient, that the flip side of that self-sufficiency became exclusion of Arabs on their land, exclusion of trading and doing business with Arabs, exclusion of having Arabs do their farming and do their labor work because they wanted to boost the prices of labor. They wanted people to make a good living at it, and you couldn't do that as long as you had all this cheap Arab labor around. So they just said, we won't have that.
We're going to welcome phone calls. I know you haven't had a chance to see the film yet because it hasn't been on television yet, but it soon will. Tuesday, June 30th on PBS, 1913, Seeds of Conflict. It's the guest didn't even know about the history, and it's a really fascinating piece of history of Palestine during the latter part of the Ottoman Empire. And it is remarkable to see how peace was omnipresent among Arabs and Christians and Jews during this period, and what happened. What were the early seeds of discontent that turned into what we have now and have had for a long period of time? Huge tension and fighting and killing. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Ben Loderman is our guest. He is the writer-director of the film, and he's done many other films, lots of work for the Frontline series and for American Experience. His independent film, The People versus Leo Frank, was broadcast nationally on PBS to rave reviews. To you, in just one moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, our guest is Professor Kathleen McGinn, and she's done some really interesting research on the advantages children have if they are raised by working mothers. Her research shows that women raised by working moms are more likely to hold supervisory positions, earn higher wages, and the men in the family are more likely to contribute to chores and spend more time as caretakers. Harvard professor Kathleen McGinn will be joining us tomorrow at 2 o'clock during this hour. All right, let's welcome phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we start with Doe in Williams Bay. Hi, Doe.
Hi.
Hi.
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I was born, and it makes me laugh, in 1932. Isn't that funny?
No. Why is that funny?
That just surprises me because I'm 12 going on 13. But anyway, I was born in Chicago to a non-religious Jewish family. So when I was about 12, I don't know exactly how old I was recruited to help create Israel for the Jews. And I was recruited by an organization called Habonim. And we danced and we sang and we did all sorts of things to get money, which we did do to create Israel, which was the chosen people a long time ago. But what my point is that they didn't tell us. They didn't tell us that we would be displacing other people in order to create that land. And that really, truly makes me ill today. And it's the reason for all of that grief that's going on there, because it wasn't an honest thing to begin with.
And I think you're not alone. I mean, and there are people who've seen the film in some screenings before the broadcast, which is on June 30th, who say, my heart is heavy. My heart is sick. I mean, of all people, Jewish people who know so much about suffering, that we should be displacing other people of all things is not what they told us. And you're right, they didn't. So what happened was that in order to buy the land, to create first a homeland and then a state, and in 1932, you're kind of right between those era of Palestine being a homeland for the Jews, and then 48, of course, becoming a state for the Jews, people, and in America and elsewhere, had what many of our grandparents called the little blue boxes, which raised money, and with coins and dollar bills, you know, for Israel. And Israel was this kind of abstract concept that many Jews and many in America grew to support and love, even if they didn't know it very well. So I think your feelings are shared by many, and you know, it is a difficult thing to reckon with.
Just, is there anything we can do about it?
Well, I mean, sure. I think there are lots of things that one can do, and there are lots of questions and discussions one can have about what should happen on the ground now. But I don't think guilt is is all that helpful at this point. I think doing things to somehow foster a coexistence, and I'm not a political expert or policy person to know whether that's going to be in the form of two states, although some people think that it's still a very real and relevant possibility that we should support, or whether it's some other kind of organization like a confederation of states, because things are fractured and there is a cement wall running down parts of the West Bank. Nobody says this is going to be a Garden of Eden. People are just working and hoping for a kind of workable solution. It never was a Garden of Eden, but at least people found a way to live harmoniously, and that would be so nice again.
Yes, it would be. And thank you very much, Joe, for your call. Tell us about, it's amazing, and it's pretty dramatically reenacted in your film, when this became violent, and it was over, of all things, grapes.
Right. So, as a Reformed Jew growing up on the West Coast, I learned what a lot of people here who are Jewish learn, which is that at the end of World War I, there was a man named Lord Balfour who, on the winning side of the British, said, the Jews deserve some homeland here. We have to carve out some space here. And what the film made me do was go back and look at what led up to that. And in fact, the film ends not at the end of World War I when Lord Balfour makes his declaration about a Jewish homeland, but just on the eve of World War I. So that's the time after this second Russian emigration, the second Aliyah, starts coming in about 1903. Over the course of that 10 years, and after a revolution in Istanbul against the Sultan in 1908, where there's a new kind of citizenry brought into being for Ottoman citizens, that everybody starts taking their own view of how it should be and who should have what, and tensions that were tamped down sometimes under the umbrella of this superpower in the region, the Ottomans, began to flare up. And it flared up among Jews, who suddenly began to think about how strategically they should use the money being raised in Europe and America to buy land for Jews and settle immigrants in greater numbers on one hand, and Arabs, who began to feel they saw the power of the Ottomans waning and saying, wait, we are a people. We're not just people. We're a people. And we need to carve out our own homeland and identity. And that tension raised and raised until people began guarding their lands.
Mm-hmm.
And once they did, then there was a question of, do you hire Arab guards, which is kind of good because it also sort of keeps the tension from rising to a point where Arabs would want to work against you in your farmland or steal from you. And then at some point around 1911 or 12, most of the settlements began, the Jewish settlements began to say, we should have just Jewish guards. And that was a real shift. And at that point, tensions ratcheted up until there were the first incidents of violence. And the one we look at is in Rehovot, partly because it's so well documented, both by the Ottomans and the Jews and the Palestinians on the land there, of what happened in this one little tiny place where some camel drivers who are coming to this new settlement to bring other goods sort of stop in the vineyard and help themselves to what's probably not more than handfuls of grapes that they put in their saddlebags. But that alerts a Jewish guard who is watching that vineyard, and there's a scuffle and a gun pulled away from the Jewish guard, and then reinforcements from both sides come from the Arab village and more from the settlement of Rehovot, and guns go off, and a camel is killed, and a horse is killed, an Arab is killed, and a Jew is killed. Mm-hmm. And we use that as our ground zero.
And you describe these guards, the Jewish guards, as, I mean, they're a pretty tough-looking group of people, as almost a paramilitary organization, speaking Yiddish, not speaking Hebrew, a tough bunch.
They were tough. They were like gangs. And, of course, you know, they had learned well from the Cossacks in Russia, because Jews had been treated so brutally that these guys picked up some bad habits, and they knew how to ride around on horses and kind of throw people around and slug them pretty hard. So it wasn't a real neighborly entrance to the new neighborhood that Eastern European Jews were coming to.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in a way, it's sort of hard to put all of this together, because what preceded this wanting to have land and being separate and not seeing Arab citizens as being, in some cases, fully human, was where the Jews had been in Eastern Europe, too. It's understandable they were looking for a place to put together a safe settlement, and that they wanted to be among themselves, because who else are you going to trust?
That's right. And they had come from the harshest of experiences, and so came with a kind of vigor and conviction that by hell or high water, they were going to make this their home, and nobody was going to get in the way. And then you do have the Sephardic Jews who are there, who speak Arabic, who have a much easier relationship with their neighbors, who say, you know what, please don't come in here and mess up the neighborhood. I mean, we all get along here, and if you might learn some Arabic and the ways of the way people live together and work together in this land, it would go a lot easier than saying, you're European, therefore you're better than anybody here, and it's going to be as you say.
Let's go to Sarah in Zion. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Hi. You know, my great-grandfather in the, like, around 1890, immigrated from Lithuania to Australia to Palestine, and he went back to Australia, and then he came and settled in Des Moines. And, So I have a lot of, I'm not Jewish, but I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood, and my best friend from high school moved to Israel and now is very conservative. And I've been to Israel, and it was just, I was torn between really feeling like I belonged there and also learning about how different sides say that, God gave them that land, and they were the first ones there. So therefore, they Israel belongs to them, and everyone else has to get out. And I'm wondering when, because from what you're saying, it doesn't sound to me like the argument that, you know, God gave us this land, and I'm going to kill you to keep it. Doesn't sound like that was there from the beginning. And I wonder, or was it? And so I'm wondering when that.
It wasn't there from the beginning, and it's a great question, Sarah, because. And I share those conflicted feelings. I've been to Israel and feel like it's home, and I've been to Israel and feel like it's not home at all. I have a daughter who lives in Israel who will tell you with great conviction that the seeds of conflict go back to exactly where you say, the Bible, and that this struggle is ancient, and who did God give the land to first? That's not what this is about, really. I also have a son who lives in Los Angeles who grew up having South Africa be an important history lesson for him. And he will tell you that Israel is today virtually one of the only examples of modern apartheid in the world. So I have to live with these kids for about 4 days a year on vacation. Mm. And, you know, one says it goes back to the Bible, the other says no.
Oh, my goodness.
It's brand new and political. And so that's what set me out on my journey. Mm. You know, I wanted to see, well, I've got to talk to the kids and I should know what I'm talking about. When did this really begin? And I think the answers we came up with, not in terms of ancient times, and we have Arab speakers in the film say, you know, No question. I mean, this land is historically yours. And then the issue becomes not that you can't be here or that Jews say we must be here. It's a question of can we both be here?
Mm-hmm. So thank you very much, Sarah, for your call. So how could this have been avoided? What were the Jews from Russia supposed to do that maybe would have precluded all that has happened since?
Well, you know, a lot of the work in our film is based on new scholarship, and a lot of that new scholarship is tumbling out of the Ottoman archives, which have just recently been opened in the past 10 years or so. So there's a whole new perspective on either the Jewish narrative that Jews grow up with, land of milk and honey, a land for a people without a land, and a whole alternate narrative that Arabs grow up with about their land.
Mm-hmm.
And what we find in that is that, and what scholarship is now saying, is that had European Jews come to this place with more sensitivity and listening closer to their Sephardic neighbors, instead of thinking that because they're European and more Western and more modern, they're better than those Sephardic people, things could have been very different. And they could have been very different at many moments in history. There are a lot of littered and tattered peace talks and secret agreements, and there were some in 1913, and, you know, there have been some very recently with the Oslo Accords and even something since. So it's not that things can't be different or this is inevitable or this struggle is genetic somehow. It just means people have to find a way to change it.
We welcome more phone calls in a moment. Here's how you can join our conversation, 800-486-8655. Ben Loderman is our guest, and his film is going to be airing on June 30th on PBS, 1913, Seeds of Conflict. He's the writer and director. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'd like to hear a little bit more, Ben, about the Young Turks Revolution, when it took place, and how it may have changed all that we're talking about. What was that revolution?
Well, we talked about the wave of nationalism that was breaking up empires, including the Ottoman Empire, around the turn of the century. So that by 1907 or 8, there was a real feeling that the Ottoman Empire was very vulnerable. And the Sultan's instinct was to really kind of tighten his grip on the outer parts of the empire, partly because the empire was desperate for money. And they raised it through taxation. There was a group, though, of intellectuals in Istanbul who joined with army officers to say, no, that's not the way. And they actually overthrew the Sultan. And that's what we call the Young Turk Revolution in 1908. And what they wanted to do was set up a different kind of sense of autonomy that would give different peoples in different parts of the empire a sense that they could control their daily lives, that they could have much more say in how they lived and governed themselves. And so it was based almost on the ideals of the French Revolution, egalite, fraternite, and that the idea was that they would convey a new sense of citizenship on everybody in the Ottoman Empire and give people a greater sense of autonomy and control over their lives.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem with that was that people wanted different things. And in Palestine, Jews wanted different things out of that than Arabs did.
Let's go to Barb in Madison next. Hi, Barb.
Hi. That's actually related to my question. I obviously haven't had a chance to see your film. But I'm curious as to, in the film and in the process of researching, how much did you explore the Palestinian narrative? Because, for example, the Palestinian narrative, while it would acknowledge that this is the age of nationalisms, et cetera, you know, in terms of people wanting more autonomy and more independence, would also very strongly say that this was the era of imperialism and the expansion of the European colonial projects all over the world. And so the Zionist project is seen as very much in that context. So I'm wondering, is that in the film, or did you consider that or not? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Barb.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Sure. It's very much in the film. And in fact, two of the main characters in the film are named Khalidi. So we have Yusuf Khalidi, who in the 1890s or so, even 1880s, is mayor of Jerusalem. And he is part of the Khalidi family, one of the most prominent families based in Jerusalem. If you go near the Wailing Wall today, just across from that area is the Khalidi Library. It's the oldest library in Jerusalem, and therefore one of the oldest continuously working libraries in the world. It's run by the Khalidi family. His nephew, Yusuf Khalidi's nephew, became a representative from Palestine in Jerusalem to the Ottoman Parliament. And if you go three generations further down the line, we come to someone named Walid Khalidi, who was a well-known professor at Harvard and is now in his late 80s or early 90s, and another cousin, Rashid Khalidi, who is considered probably the most preeminent Arab and Palestinian scholar in the United States and therefore in the world, and teaches at Columbia. In fact, he was friends with someone named Barack Obama, which somehow got tied up. And so Rashid Khalidi doesn't really talk to the media because he doesn't want the name linked to Obama or vice versa. But those two were young professors together at Columbia, which is where Rashid Khalidi is. And many of the experts in our film are his doctoral dissertation students who have now come into their own as young scholars, who are in the forefront of mining these archives in Istanbul right now.
Hmm. Let's go to William, Land O'Lakes. Hi, William.
Hello, hello. I didn't get the gentleman's last name. Is it just Drotman, Portman?
Loderman.
Loderman, I beg your pardon. I applaud your sentences about 2 minutes ago when you said that the incoming, especially from the Russian immigrants, they should have listened to the Sephardic Jews, because in 1972, that tells you how old I am, in 1972, in Foreign Affairs, as an article that I copied and kept for years and it got yellow on the edges, that article was written by Nahum Goldman. Are you familiar with that name?
I'm not. Forgive me.
He's the former president of the World Zionist Organization. And the article is about 5-6 pages. The summary is this. He said, after 25 years of the foundation of Israel, I have come to the conclusion that it was based and founded on the wrong way, because we should have taken advantage of the hospitality and the generosity of the Palestinian people there. So in a sense,
so
you said the same thing. Not only you must listen to the Sephardic, because they are right close in culture. I met a lady whose ancestors came from Urfa, Turkey, and she is Sephardic. It's as if I had met a relative. And she had the same feelings towards me and to the whole Arab cause. But this is what's missing, is the Sephardic. But, of course, I believe there must be now a small minority in Israel. Maybe you can tell me, Mr. Loderman.
Well, the percentages have definitely reversed. There used to be a strong Sephardic majority 100 years ago, because that's who lived in the area. And now, with the waves of immigration, which don't stop, as our film does, with the second Aliyah, but goes on to a third and fourth and fifth and more waves since, of both Eastern Europeans and Westerners at this point. So the questions are overlapping, and you're good to point that out, that there were questions of modernism and the way people identified themselves and sensitivities toward culture. Someone earlier in the program talked about a kind of imperial nature of Westerners, and all of that comes into play.
Hmm. And thanks very much for your call. Was there interaction between the Ashkenazi Jews and the Sephardic Jews in Palestine, or did they remain pretty separate?
No, there was tremendous interaction.
There
because
was.
Because the arriving Ashkenazi Jews who spoke Russian or sometimes German, they needed these Arab Jews, these Sephardic Jews, to find ways to manipulate the laws and manipulate their business dealings to their advantage. And so there's one character in our film, I mentioned Albert Entebbe, who at first was voicing many of the expressions our last caller talked about, was, why aren't you listening to the Sephardic better? Who ultimately become leaned upon by those Eastern European Jews, and as tensions rise between Jews and Arabs in the area, feel like they're torn between and ultimately need to make a decision. They're not sure they believe in Zionism or political Zionism, at least. But when push comes to shove, they say, I'm Jewish, the Ashkenazi are Jewish, and eventually they kind of become co-opted by those Ashkenazi Jews.
Hmm. Do you have any experiences while filming in Palestine that you want to tell us about?
Oh, my God.
Oh, bad.
Oh, my God, bring on the next hour. First of all, the scene you mentioned, which is kind of our dramatic penultimate scene at the very end of the film, where there is literally a shootout, is something that we were filming in Israel. So not only are there not horses, particularly because there's not a strong film industry in Israel today, so even the wrangling of the animals, there are sort of three good horses in Israel you can shoot with, and only one camel. We called her Muriel, and she was pregnant during this whole thing.
Oh my goodness!
And we said, no worries, we just have to have a shootout, and of course we were filming at a monastery up in the hills that has been used for a lot of period filmmaking, so we weren't the first, but we were the first to stage a shootout. Well, that monastery is in a very contested part of Israel, and there is a very severely religious community next door, okay? So we have our guns and our actors.
Oh, my goodness, Ben.
And then we have people starting to show up with guns.
Oh.
Okay. And we had, of course, arranged this all in advance. And so we had a perimeter that, of course, these people are able to walk right through of police. And ultimately, we were not able to fire the guns. So the gunshots you see in the film were digitally put in afterward, because you're not even allowed to have toy guns out after darkness. So it was very interesting. It was interesting having Arab actors play Jews,
right?
Because their accents needed to be a certain way, and there were some Arab actors, especially, but also experts from Palestine who did not want to partake in the film because they are part of a cultural boycott at this point.
Oh, my goodness. I should have asked you that question a little earlier. We should have taken the next hour. Ben Loderman, our guest. Thanks, Ben. The film 1913, Seeds of Conflict, premieres on Tuesday, June 30th on PBS. It's a history worth knowing. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP for on-air production.